Welcome to another episode of 30 Minutes in the New Testament. 30 Minutes in the New Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. That means you can go over to 1517.org and check out the whole family of podcasts over there. You can get a little bit of something for everyone. There's a little bit of something for you. Go check it out. Hey, do you like all the stuff we're doing? Do you like the Christ Hold Fast stuff? All the things that don't cost you anything? All the things that are free? All the things that 1517 does? They just explode out on the internet like a gift bomb? Well, you know what? We could use your help. You could become a supporter. All of that stuff is made possible by a whole lot of people doing a little. And so if you would be interested in helping us out, you can go over to Christ Hold Fast, go to the donate page, click that thing. Every little bit helps, and we can continue to gift the world with the free gospel of Jesus Christ. Eric, I just got back from Hattiesburg, Mississippi. Had a great, great city event there. Got to meet a whole bunch of people that listen to this, listen to other things, that read stuff. Fantastic to meet all you guys. It is it's always a humbling experience that you can throw a date on the calendar and have an event and people actually show up on a Saturday and spend all day with you and they're interested in what you have to say. That's never take that for granted. That's always weird. And so it's great to meet all of you guys, and thanks for coming out. And I'm looking forward to more and more of those.
From the pictures I saw of the event and from the people I spoke to about the event, I heard it went really well, and glad to hear that. It looked like it was a lot of fun. They're always fun. I mean, every one-day event, you know, every conference we do, you know, Here We Still Stand conference, of course, is the big one coming up next month. Mm-hmm. I mean, literally in less than a month, Dan, you and I will be in the thick of it in San Diego, getting stuff set up, getting ready to go. I mean, it's happening.
It is happening. And, you know, it is sold out. And I know that you guys know that. But we are doing a legit live stream this year, like a real legit live stream. And you can register for that. It's free. But you'll to get it, you got to sign up. And so you can go over to herewestillstand.org. Just click on the live stream. Throw in your email address and your name, and then you'll get sent the email at the appropriate time to log on. You can watch what you want to watch, not watch what you don't, but you'll be all registered up. So I encourage you to do that if you want to participate that way.
Dude, there's tons of people signed up for that too, which is awesome.
Tons. Yeah. Much bigger online audience than people that are actually there. That we cannot hold all the people, Eric. We cannot hold them all.
This is a good problem. This is the problem I'm praying for with my church in New York City, with my church plant. So many people that we can't hold them. I want that problem.
That's it. All right. So where are we at in the gospel according to Acts?
We are at Acts chapter 17, verse 16, just to bring you up to speed on where we left off. Actually, Paul and Silas and Timothy are separated and in Berea and Thessalonica. And Paul is on his own by the time we pick it up here in verse 16 in Athens. So we read verse 16. Now, while Paul was waiting for them at Athens, his spirit was provoked within him as he saw that the city was full of idols. Now, indeed, these are like statues. And we know that this was very much a part of the ancient Greek world. There were statues to every sort of god in the pantheon of Greek gods. So we have plenty of historical data recording that this is the case. So he's just walking around seeing all these statues and his spirit is provoked. So what does Paul do when his spirit is provoked at seeing all this idolatry? Verse 17, he reasons in the synagogue with the Jews and the devout persons and in the marketplace every day with those who happen to be there. I love that. Indiscriminate language. Anybody who's around, I'm going to reason with you. And I love the fact that there's a dialogue going on there.
Yeah,
right?
It doesn't make it sound like he's lighting them up, but it sounds like he's having a civil discourse.
That's right. And this is where you get sort of the picture of almost what apologetics sounds like in the New Testament, where it goes from being, you know, he's preaching in the synagogue, which is typical of Paul's action, typical of wherever he travels, to, okay, now I'm just going to go talk to people wherever I can find them and try to talk to them about the gospel. Incidentally, whenever I read this passage, I can't help but think of what I did, you know, for the first, especially almost every day for the first year and a half after moving into New York City to start Epiphany, is I would go out literally into the marketplace, in this case, cafes and various other meeting spots, and do the same thing. I would try to reason with anybody who happened to be there that didn't have earbuds and their MacBook out to tell me they clearly didn't want to talk, because that was where you needed to start. And that's where Paul starts here. So verse 18, some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers also conversed with him. And some said, what does this babbler wish to say? Others said, he seems to be a preacher of foreign divinities. He seems to be a preacher of foreign divinities because he was preaching Jesus in the resurrection. And they took him and brought him to the Areopagus, saying, may we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting? For you bring some strange things to our ears. We wish to know, therefore, what these things mean. Now all the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there would spend their time in nothing except telling or hearing something new.
Well, you know that the Stoics are making a comeback.
What do you mean?
If Instagram is any providing any evidence of what is trending, I'm seeing a lot of Stoics popping up. So these are these guys, man, saying all kinds of smart sounding stuff. Paul gets in there talking about the resurrection. They say, hey, now hold on, what? Mm-hmm. This is a whole other thing. Now, but they like the idea of new teaching though, so they bring him up and say, hey, let's have a presentation of exactly mm-hmm. what you're talking about.
Yeah, the Epicureans and Stoics were the two of the most popular philosophies of the time. And if you might have heard somebody described as a Stoic person, which is to say somebody that doesn't seem to be very emotional, doesn't seem to be very invested, and that related to the philosophy of the day. So yeah, when we talk about Epicureanism and Stoicism, Stoicism was basically this philosophy that tried not to feel anything and tried to deny, you know, any sort of physical, manifestations or materialism. It's sort of related to what Gnosticism might become. It's a devaluing of feeling. On the other hand, the Epicureans are sort of hedonists, basically, and they're all about going for sensual pleasure. So these are two opposing schools at the time. And so they're very popular schools. And here Paul is invited to speak to all of these philosophers in, of course, the most famous city of philosophy in Athens. So it says, verse 22, so Paul, standing in the midst of the Areopagus, said, men of Athens, which, by the way, Areopagus means Mars Hill. So I only bring that up because there's been quite a few, actually, famous recent churches with the same name, Mars Hill. It's based on this passage, Areopagus. So Paul, standing in the midst of the Areopagus, said, men of Athens, I perceive that in every way you are very religious. For as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also an altar with this inscription, to the unknown God. What therefore you worship is unknown. This I proclaim to you, the God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man, nor is he served by human hands, as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God and perhaps feel their way toward him and find him, that he is actually not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being, as even some of your own poets have said, for we are indeed his offspring. Being then God's offspring, we ought not to think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and imagination of man. The times of ignorance God overlooked, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent, because he has fixed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man whom he has appointed, and of this he has given assurance to all by raising him from the dead. Well, let's just stop there, because there's an awful lot to dig into in Paul's talk. First of all, there's a difference in the way Paul presents here than maybe some of his other sermons. What are some of the differences?
Well, he's not bringing up the forefathers. He's not bringing up Moses and Abraham because that's not who he's dealing with. They don't care about that stuff. What he is doing is he's observing that they believe in God or gods, and he's using the fact that they already believe in divinity to proclaim the one true God. Because if you look at what he does, he's like, hey, I see you got an altar to the unknown God. So they're obviously are worshiping something that they think is unknown. Now they have all these other gods too, but they don't think that they've necessarily figured all the things out. What he does then, he's like, I'll tell you about this unknown God. And then he basically says that this unknown God is the Lord, and that he does everything. I mean, like, look at the, like, after he says, like, I'll tell you about this unknown God, he doesn't say, like, he's the God of crops, or like, he's the God of the sun, or the God of rain, or whatever. He's like, he's the God who made everything, formed everything, gives everything. I mean, he is all of the God. Everything that you think any other God does, like, it's actually him.
Yeah, and I love the fact that he takes, so we know that his initial response to Athens is to be upset. I mean, the word that's used back in verse 16 is the word for provoked, is, you know, troubled, like deeply troubled in his spirit. He's upset at seeing all the idols. And so you know he doesn't like it. But Paul, instead of beginning his talk at the Areopagus, blasting them for their idolatry, you know, holding up a sign, you know, or, you know, yelling at them for all their false ideas, instead, he's very tactful. He uses something they're used to seeing that they already believe in as a springboard to then talk about the true God. It's a very wise tactic, and he doesn't come blasting out at them. He tries to relate to them with something they're already familiar with. Very, very wise move for us to consider as well. If we want to actually bring the gospel to people, we have to think about the things that they already accept to be true, and then explain how those things are actually either fulfilled or contradicted by the true God of Scripture. But we have to speak in language that they actually, that people around us will actually understand.
You mean, so it's good, I do think that it's a good thing that he doesn't like pull his best sermon on hell out of his back pocket and then explain to all of these people how that's exactly where they're going if they don't repent right now.
Yeah, well, this is why that, you know, the street preachers that you see so often, most of the time are not connecting with anyone. They're just annoying people. And I'm not saying that God can't use a street preacher. You know, I mean, of course, God can use anything for his purposes. But generally speaking, we all know this. I mean, speaking of New York again, I mean, almost every day I walk by somebody that's yelling a message somewhere, and you know what it sounds like to people there. It just sounds like noise, like the rest of the city.
It's the opposite of reasoning with people.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what he's really trying to do. And so he's using stuff that they already know as a bridge to talk about the Lord of heaven and earth. And he even quotes their own poets. So he's aware of their culture. So where he says, in him we live and move and have our being, that's actually a quote from poets that they would know. And then he even goes further and says, for we are indeed his offspring. Again, quotes from poets that they would know, specifically Epimenides of Crete. There's also a Stoic poet, Aratus. Remember who asked him to come? The Stoics. So he's using stuff that they know, that they're familiar with, to bring the gospel to them.
Yeah, and he ultimately gets to the resurrection of Christ, which of course is going to be like the ultimate freak them out, because it's one thing to, like, you know, to talk about all of these different all these different, you know, gods doing all of these God things, but when you talk about to prove that he's God, he rose this person from the dead. Well, that's a whole other thing.
Yeah, well, then that's really controversial to the Greek mind, because the Greek mind is big on devaluing the flesh. And here is where the controversy begins. He proclaims this, and then verse 32, it says, now when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some mocked. Well, yeah, yes, they did. Very much so, because it just seemed like that's crazy for their philosophy of the time. It just, there's no way divinity would ever choose to exalt flesh like that. But others said, we will hear you again about this. So Paul went out from their midst. But some men joined him and believed, among whom also were Dionysius the Areopagite, and a woman named Damaris, and others with them. And that's really what, I mean, what we can hope to expect whenever the gospel is shared. You're always going to have a mixture of things. You're going to have some that mock it. You're going to have some that will say, all right, I'm open to hearing more about this. And then you're actually going to have, what do you know, some people that believe it and accept it and receive it and become Christians and are changed.
Yeah, and to me, you know, when you're talking to people, the I'd like to continue this conversation, it's like that's a win.
Oh, that's a huge win. Yeah, I mean, as a matter of fact, when I would go around and reason with people in the marketplace, if I could get people to agree to give me their email, and I would actually say I'd love to continue this conversation with you, if they were willing to do that, I felt like victory is mine. I had no illusions that I was going to just see converts right then and there on the street of New York City. But if I could just continue the conversation with people, I felt like, all right, we're getting somewhere.
Yeah.
So we've come to, speaking of getting somewhere, we're at chapter 18. It says, after this, Paul left Athens and went to Corinth. And of course, we all know Corinth because of the two letters to the Corinthian church. There's actually more letters that were written, but we don't have them today. At least according to Paul's writings, there are more letters. But Corinth is a very famous, well-known city, and very important city, very wealthy. And it was a place that lots of commerce went through. And so it made sense that he would go there. It wasn't far from Athens. And it says, verse 2, he found a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had commanded all the Jews to leave Rome. And he went to see them, and because he was of the same trade, he stayed with them and worked, for they were tent makers by trade. And he reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath and tried to persuade Jews and Greeks. Who are these Priscilla and Aquila people?
Well, I think they're tent makers. It's interesting that Paul has got like multiple skills. I mean, so he's a tent maker or a tanner, and he's a Greek, and he's a Jew, and
he's not like me, man.
He's a great debater.
Yeah, like I have no skills besides like kind of being able to preach. Paul knew how to do a bunch of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And so, so this couple takes him in, and it's interesting. He goes to work. So he doesn't just stay there. He's actually working.
Yeah, well, this is the way it kind of had to happen. You'll hear Paul actually reference the fact that he works in his letters, that he tries not to take a salary or doesn't take a salary anywhere he goes, doesn't take gifts, even though he acknowledges actually to in the Corinthians, Second Corinthians letter, that he has the right to take a salary from his calling as others do. He does not. He chooses to work, and this is what he does to basically put food on the table. Is he's a tent maker.
Yeah.
So when Silas and Timothy, verse 5, arrived from Macedonia, Paul was occupied with the word, testifying to the Jews that the Christ was Jesus. It means that the Messiah was Jesus. And when they opposed and reviled him, he shook out his garments and said to them, your blood be on your own heads. I am innocent. From now on, I will go to the Gentiles. And he left there and went to the house of a man named Titius Justus, a worshiper of God. His house was next door to the synagogue. Crispus, the ruler of the synagogue, believed in the Lord, together with his entire household.
Oh, nope, there we go.
Another household passage.
More of that. There's a common theme here.
There is indeed throughout this entire book. And many of the Corinthians hearing Paul believed and were baptized. There's another common theme. Believe and baptize together always, always. In verse 9, and the Lord said to Paul one night in a vision, do not be afraid, but go on speaking and do not be silent. For I am with you, and no one will attack you to harm you. For I have many in this city who are my people. And he stayed a year and 6 months teaching the word of God among them.
Yeah, so this is some of the passages that make you realize like how much time is going by. You know, as we like move through this, and it's like he's going from this place to this place. This is the kind of passage that makes you realize that this stuff is happening over a fairly significant amount of time. So I mean, he's over here in Corinth for a year and a half,
right?
And I think that that's the case most places he goes. He's there a while.
And it seems, I mean, if I'm just reading between the lines a little bit, just it seems like Paul may be a little discouraged at this moment. I mean, from his rejection in the synagogue, you know, he's like, okay, fine, I'm going to the Gentiles from now on. Because God gives him this vision in the midst of this time to just sort of reassure him, like, you know what, don't be afraid, keep on going, don't be silent, I'm with you. There's many people here that I've called to be mine, and you're going to be the one that preaches to them, to bring them in.
Yeah, and you see this with Paul. I mean, you can see this in Romans that, you know, Paul does have a Jewish background, and he really wants the Jewish community to come to faith. He wants the Jews to believe that Jesus is the Christ, that he is the Messiah. And, you know, it's not going well a lot of the time. I mean, the Jews are the ones freaking out on him a lot. You can sense the frustration when he's like, I'll just go to the Gentiles.
Yeah. And, and this is this passage, and I would say the second half of Acts 17 and the beginning of Acts 18 is really a great passage of encouragement for pastors, church planters, in one regard, because there's this sense, you know, that there's this reminder that God sees behind the scenes. You might feel like you're preaching your heart out and doing everything you can to bring the gospel to people, and you're just, it doesn't seem to be doing much. It seems to be rejected. You seem to be getting pushed back all the time, or it just seems to be ignored. And you know, you need to be reminded, like Paul was here, there are people that God is calling in the city, and he is going to use you to reach these people. Might not seem like it, and it might seem like it's slower than you expect it to be. I mean, it does say Paul stayed a year and 6 months teaching the word of God among them. So it took some time before this church in Corinth was going to get established and get stronger. You know, it always takes time.
Yeah.
So verse 12, but when Gallio was proconsul of Achaia, the Jews made a united attack on Paul and brought him before the tribunal. And this is where you really need to remember those words in that vision, saying, this man is persuading people to worship God contrary to the law. But when Paul was about to open his mouth, Gallio said to the Jews, if it were a matter of wrongdoing or vicious crime, O Jews, I would have reason to accept your complaint. But since it is a matter of questions about words and names and your own law, see to it yourselves. I refuse to be a judge of these things. And he drove them from the tribunal, and they all seized Sosthenes, the ruler of the synagogue, and beat him in front of the tribunal. But Gallio paid no attention to any of this. It's such a strange passage. I mean, basically, they're trying to get, you know, the Roman authorities, they're trying to get Paul in trouble for preaching what they view as heresy before the Roman authorities. The Roman authorities are like, what? Who cares? Everybody here believes in a bunch of different gods. I'm not here to, you know, decide what's heretical and not amongst you people. Leave me alone.
Yeah, yeah.
Just sort of dismissive.
What's really weird is that this backfires, and this dude, the ruler of the synagogue, gets a beat down.
Yeah, I know. It just seems so odd to me, you know, but yeah, so this is, it doesn't work, and Paul is able to continue preaching the gospel. All right, so after this, verse 18, Paul stayed many days longer and then took leave of the brothers and set sail for Syria, and with him Priscilla and Aquila. At Cenchreae, he had cut his hair, for he was under a vow. And they came to Ephesus, and he left them there. But he himself went into the synagogue and reasoned with the Jews. So here, again, Paul's like, I'm just going to the Gentiles. I'm not dealing with you anymore. Until he gets to Ephesus, and he's like, all right, I'm going to go to the synagogue again. I'm going to try again. It just reminds me of Paul's words in Romans, where he is so desperate to see his fellow Jews become Christians that he just can't stop. He can't give up.
Yeah. This is, you see Paul, it doesn't matter who it is, Gentiles, Stoics, Jews, like he can't help it, man. He's going to go and try to reach anyone and everyone.
Yeah. And so it says, verse 20, when they asked him to stay for a longer period, he declined. But on taking leave of them, he said, I will return to you if God wills. And he set sail from Ephesus. When he had landed at Caesarea, he went up and greeted the church and then went down to Antioch. And after spending some time there, he departed and went from one place to the next through the region of Galatia and Pergia, strengthening all the disciples. And here Paul is, so if you remember a couple chapters back, Paul was sort of prevented from going to Asia with the gospel. Here he now is in Galatia, and Pergia is part of Asia Minor, and he is strengthening all the disciples there. He's strengthening the brothers. So Paul's a traveling man. He is truly just going from place to place to place to either strengthen churches that already exist or to try and get new churches started. And everywhere he goes, it seems there is a new church started. That's his mission, and he is doing that. And we know, of course, with Ephesus, you know, the church that he said, I hope I can get back to you. Eventually, he will, and he'll be with them for quite some time. Ephesus becomes a very significant church in the ministry of Paul. But for right now, it's only a stopover before he goes to Galatia. So all of these letters that you're all these places that you're hearing about, you can reference the letters in the New Testament. We have the letter to the Galatians and the letter to the Ephesians and the letters to the Corinthians. And all of these places, this is happening right now. This is real life. And Paul is writing to these people.
Yeah,
that we read about.
That's one of the cool things about Acts is if you're familiar with the New Testament, if you're familiar with the epistles, sometimes you're like, oh, this is the letter that Paul wrote to the Colossians, you know, the church in Colossae. That's not just a church in Colossae that you have. There's a lot more to it than that. It's not just a church in Ephesus. Actually, the church in Colossae, I don't think Paul established that church, but so that's a bad example. But for Corinth and Ephesus and Galatia and all these other places, these are places he's been. I mean, where he went in, preached the word, suffered persecution, people believed, the church was planted, he moved on from there. Like that's what's going on with all these places. So it's part of the reason why when Paul, in the Paul's letters, when he sometimes names people by names, that's important too. It's not important to us because we're like, I don't know who these people are, but they're people, actual people that he knew that were part of who he had left behind and who were running things at these churches that he had started. So all of it matters.
Yeah, and it's actually whenever I've preached through an epistle, I will preach on the names even at the final chapter. It's a section that I think a lot of preachers will skip, but I do it because that is, the church is made up of a bunch of anonymous names. And still today, that's the case. The church most of the time is made up of a bunch of people that maybe don't mean a whole lot to the rest of the world, but they mean a whole lot to you as their pastor. And so it's important to emphasize that these people that weren't known by the ancient world or known by us today, they really matter. These are saints that are sitting with us. These are part of the great cloud of witnesses that are worshiping with us every Sunday when we get together.
Right. That's right. And that's it, man. We are out of time, but Paul's going to continue on. He's going to be hitting up Ephesus and onward from there. Hey, if you would do us a favor and rate and review the podcast on iTunes, that would help us out. If you want to tune into the live stream of Here We Still Stand, if you're for some reason not registered, you waited too long, you couldn't make it happen, whatever it was, do that over at herewestillstand.org. Eric, I will see you next week.
Sounds good.